from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Whether you're an artist or an army officer, chaos, or at least a contained form of chaos, can be your friend. So argue the authors of two recent books. One is titled The Chaos Imperative, the other Zigzag. And though Ori Brafman and Keith Sawyer approach the quest for creative problem-solving in different ways, they share a belief that the search for solutions rarely follows a straight line. Instead, you have to be open to quick course corrections that sometimes take you to the edge of chaos. A conversation with Keith Sawyer and Ori Brafman next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in today for Michael Krasny. Creativity isn't magic, doesn't come out of nowhere like the proverbial bolt out of the blue. Instead, two new books argue that to find creative solutions, be it in business, art, science, even the military, you have to position yourself to ask the right questions, to see the problem before you with clarity, unencumbered by preconceived solutions. Sometimes that might mean holding a meeting without an agenda, attended by unlikely combinations of participants. Sometimes it means being willing to toss out your plan and turn in a new direction. And oddly, sometimes it means being open to chaos. Joining us to talk about those thoughts and those principles, Ori Brafman. He is an organizational business consultant, consults with Fortune 500 companies, and the author of The Chaos Imperative, How Chance and Disruption Increase Innovation, Effectiveness, and Success. Also the author of The Starfish and the Spider and Sway. Ori Brafman, good morning.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Happy to have you join us. And joining us this morning from the University of North Carolina, Keith Sawyer, who is the Morgan Distinguished Professor in Educational Innovations and the author of the new book, Zigzag, The Surprising Path to Greater Creativity. Keith Sawyer, good morning as well.
Good morning to you.
Good morning, Keith.
Happy to have you both join us. You know, we just got off of an hour talking about a chaotic situation, the situation in Egypt, and how you respond to that. And so it's interesting to me to even think about that possibility of using the principle of chaos to deal with a chaotic situation. But is that indeed, Ori Brafman, some of what ought to be thought about if you're in the military or in government and you're confronting a situation like Egypt? You need to think about or put yourself in a position where you kind of are open to chaos?
Absolutely. There's no question that the world changed since 9/11. I did my undergrad at Berkeley, at UC Berkeley. I was a peace and conflict studies major. So the last call I ever expected to get was from a general in the U.S. Army. About 3 years ago, I was contacted by General Martin Dempsey, who's now the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And he invited me over to come visit his office. At the time, I knew nothing about the military. He had 4 stars on his uniform. I thought he had maybe a boss who had 5 stars. And we sat down. We talked about how different the world had become in the last 12 years, and specifically how we can't even imagine who our next opponent is going to be. Is it going to be China? Is it going to be something that comes out of the Middle East? Is it going to be Yemen? And because we don't know who the next opponent is going to be, we have to embrace the idea of becoming adaptable. We have to inoculate ourselves, because there's so much chaos happening in the world, we have to inoculate ourselves to chaos by, believe it or not, adopting a little bit of chaos into the system.
So how do you do that? Here you are, a guy from Berkeley, vegan, no less, talking with the would-be chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and saying, General, you gotta embrace a little bit of chaos here. I mean, what does that actually mean? What is it that you were suggesting that he do that would allow him to contend with this chaotic world?
Right. It's not an easy conversation. And what was interesting to me is that the leaders of the military are actually much more nuanced and thoughtful than I expected, to be honest. And put yourself in the position of this guy for a second. So at the time, he was about to be in charge of the army. So it's a 1,000,000-person organization. You know that the world is going to be a different place. The question isn't whether they need to change. The question is how. So he's sitting across the table from me and he says, look, I know we need to change. I know we need to fight more effectively than we did, say, in Afghanistan and Iraq. But how do you change? And I look at him straight in the eye, and my first response, which was my honest response, was, I don't know. I don't purport to know the solutions that the army should use in order to change. And in honesty, I told him, I don't think you know either. Because of the stars on your uniform, you're too far removed from the edge of the network in order to realize what actually needs to happen. But what we can do is we can enable people in the organization who do know, who do have the answers, create a little bit of chaos there so there's some conversations, there's some open space, and let those answers emerge from the bottom up. Organizations are very good at doing top-down delivery of information, right? You will do this, you will do this, here are some orders. We're not as good as getting information from the bottom up, and that's really where this comes in.
And Keith Sawyer, you're also someone who believes that we put too much into organizational charts. Is that part of how you work to start forming more creative responses to problems, by just tossing a bit of that out and being more open to where information comes from within an organization?
Absolutely. And the key is figuring out how to do that. In my own perspective on creativity actually does have a link with San Francisco. It's the 1960s band, The Grateful Dead, a sort of legendary improvisational rock band. In college, I was a huge Deadhead. And part of the reason I was attracted to that music is because I had been a jazz pianist from a very young age in high school. And the key about jazz is that it is improvised, and it's an ensemble improvisation, right? You're doing it with other people. One of the things I discovered when I talked to people about jazz is that they seem to think it's anything goes, right? you can just play whatever you want. And that's how you get improvisation, is a sort of randomness. But the challenge for a jazz ensemble, and even for a group like the Grateful Dead, is figuring out a way to make it consistently effective so that it's more likely to lead to effective performance outcomes. So whenever I think about creativity, I think about that improvisational process. And it is exactly like Ori says, it's one of a bottom-up, emergent innovation. It's people coming together through social networks and collaboration. And it's true that it's just not predictable. You can't know the outcome in advance.
You quote the jazz musician Charles Mingus as saying, you can't improvise on nothing. You improvise on something. So chaos or being open to any possibility doesn't mean that you come at this without knowledge. I mean, you have to know how to play the instrument, right?
There is so much expertise that goes into this type of performance, whether it's jazz or rock improvisation, or one of my big research sites was Chicago Improvisational Theater Groups, which is a fascinating example of this sort of unpredictable, zigzagging, improvisational, emergent creativity. But absolutely, they experiment with structures all the time. They call them games. The game is the format for the five-minute scene they're going to do on stage. And they're constantly experimenting, right? There's so many different ways you could sort of structure the improvisation. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it leads to a 30-minute performance. Sometimes it's a 30-second performance.
One of the things that you suggest, Ori Brafman, is that you shouldn't be afraid to have a meeting without an agenda. I have to say that to me that sounds like a really terrible idea, that you would just sort of people would have be to just kind of go all over the place and that you wouldn't get your business done. Now, that probably says more about my approach to things than I'd like to admit. But why is it good to sort of start a meeting and not know where you're going?
Right. It sounds so inefficient, doesn't it? And riffing on what Keith was saying about the Dead, you think of a bunch of Deadheads sitting on a couch saying, okay, there's a meeting about nothing and we'll just kind of hang out to see what happens. There's a really interesting story about using this idea that Keith is talking about of jazz and using it within organizations. And the idea, there's a group called Group Jazz led by Lisa Kimball and a nonprofit called the Plexus Institute. And they went into hospitals A huge problem in hospitals today is something called MRSA, which is antibiotic-resistant staph infection. This is really bad stuff. More people die of MRSA than from HIV/AIDS every year in the United States. Now, the problem is huge, but the solution is very easy. All doctors have to do is wash their hands, and it's not that hard, or wash their hands or sanitize their hands. And what do hospitals do in order to try to get doctors to wash their hands? Well, they put up signs saying, wash your hands, and the signs were pretty much ineffective. So what did they do? They put up bigger signs, wash your hands. That didn't work. So they send the doctors to, and remember, these are people who practice modern medicine. They know the ideas of sanitation. They send them to trainings, half an hour trainings about why you should wash your hands. And those don't work. So you send them to longer trainings, and on and on and on it goes. The idea is that information does not change behavior. If it did, all of us would floss and no one would smoke. Instead, they brought in this idea of how do you have, if you will, jazz. A little bit of structure, but a lot of freedom. And they started having meetings with specifically no agenda. It wasn't about how do you get people to wash their hands. It was, let's see, what are all the people in the hospital feel about this? What are their thoughts? What are their experiences? And all of a sudden, someone very unlikely, a janitor, starts making an observation saying, you know what, in this one wing where there's not a lot of MRSA, the garbage cans are filled with gloves. And in places where there is a lot of MRSA, the garbage cans are virtually empty. Well, let's go talk to these people. So they go and they talk to the wings and they said, well, the reason we're not wearing gloves isn't because we don't know we wash our hands. We know that. But it's because we have extra small hands and you guys don't have extra small gloves. Well, what if you give you extra small gloves? Would you wear them? Of course we would. We're not crazy. We're not stupid. We want to prevent MRSA. So simply putting extra small gloves in this wing all of a sudden decreases the amount of MRSA in the hospital dramatically. The point here is that you wouldn't have gotten to that point if you had an agenda. Because the agenda would have focused on what kind of training can we send the doctors to? Or what kind of posters can we have that are more effective? As opposed to having some looseness. And again, there's a balance between having complete looseness and having complete rigidity. And that's where the jazz comes in.
Ori Brafman, the author of The Chaos Imperative, joining us along with Keith Sawyer. His book is Zigzag, The Surprising Path to Greater Creativity, which chimes in, Keith Sawyer, with a point you make, which is that it's really important to ask the right question. And in this case, the right question was, what size gloves do we need for people to wear? How do you learn, I guess, how to ask the right question when it might not be obvious? The obvious question would be, how do we solve the MRSA problem? Maury Brafman was saying that's not the right question. The right question is layered somehow below that. So how do you get there?
That is a great story. I love it. And I see it as a story about getting information to the people who need it, or sometimes called knowledge management. And what happens in most organizations is the structure of the organization leads to people talking to other people who have the same information they do. And breakthrough innovations, surprising new innovations, tend to come from combinations of very different kinds of people holding very different information. And most organizational structures aren't very good at bringing together very different kinds of people. So innovative organizations are figured out different ways to have these kind of serendipitous encounters or bumping into people who are very much not like you, like the physician being in the same room with the janitor. So this often leads to a reformulation of the question. A lot of times when people are having trouble coming up with a creative solution, it's because they pose the problem incorrectly, or it just they're asking the wrong question. And we see this from Nobel Prize winners and even fine art painters. They all say coming up with the right presentation of the problem is the key to innovation.
You tell a story about art, and so let's sort of cover the waterfront here because we were going from army to hospitals. So let's talk about art for a moment, that the more creative art is generated when people keep looking at the problem and keep sort of repositioning the problem. In other words, asking questions as opposed to just sort of sitting right down and painting.
Oh, absolutely. We call it in creativity research problem finding. Creativity. And artists use these terms themselves. Most of us don't think of painting as problem-focused, right, or problem-solving. But this is how visual artists think about approaching their work. And studies have been done of, for example, one at the MFA program at the Art Institute in Chicago that found that the most creative painters, the ones whose work sold for the highest valuation, the ones who continued painting for 20 years, 30 years, rather than dropping out altogether, they were the ones who engaged in this problem-finding style where they would spend hours simply playing around, well, it would look to us like playing around with paint on a canvas and constantly changing the image so that every 5 minutes it looks like a completely different composition. What they're doing is they're exploring the space to try to identify a good visual problem.
I was in the state of Maine the week before last and went to an art exhibit, went one day, of the painter Andrew Wyeth. And alongside one of his paintings, Ori Broffman, was a little commentary from Wyeth in which he said, when I don't sort of go looking for things to paint. I just go looking. I go out for a walk and I just sort of try to be open to whatever is there. Is that important to not come at things with sort of, I'm going to go looking for X. You just have to go looking?
Exactly, and it's so counterintuitive. The way we think about whether you're painting a picture or writing a book or taking on a problem is to take it head on, right? To work through the problem and try and solve the solution and spend all-nighters. And that component is very important. That being said, it's equally important to take time away from the problem, to go off task. I call it being in white space. There's new research that suggests that our brains are actually wired to work on a problem when we're not focusing on it. It's something called the default mode network. And that when we're not on task, when we're going on a walk, taking a nap, even daydreaming, our brain actually starts looking at problems from different perspectives, different parts of the brain start talking to each other, reevaluating the problem, reflecting in it. And that's when we get those eureka moments where it's like, wait a second, I never thought about doing a painting this way. It's how Einstein got the idea for the theory of relativity. It's how J.K. Rowling came up with the idea of sitting on a train in London without a pen, where she gets all of a sudden the characters for Harry Potter. There's millions of stories like that. And the idea is that we have a problem-solving machine in our brain. And the idea is, how do you capitalize upon this as opposed to keep on working straight to the problem?
And Keith Sawyer, does that also mean that even though we have a problem-solving center in our brain, that we have to somehow put our brain on pause for a moment when we're looking about, because our brain has a tendency, sort of like when you're typing and you have like the autocorrect system, it sort of fills in what you think you want to say, and your brain sort of comes with all this history and sort of shapes the problem based on previous experience. And what you want to do is set that aside?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a tension in getting through our lives, right? We have experience, and experience makes us better at things. So we develop all sorts of routines and habits that get us through the day more quickly and more efficiently, or get us through a job. That's part of what professional disciplinary expertise is it's mastery of a repertoire, right, a set of routines. But then the challenge is you find yourself on autopilot and executing the same sorts of actions over and over, you're never going to come up with anything new and innovative. And in many cases, you won't even notice if you come across something new and innovative. There's a sort of mindfulness to what you were describing and what Ori was talking about, is this awareness of things in your environment that might not be obviously related to the problem you're working on that tends to result in those surprising new insights, is these ideas that come out of nowhere that you wouldn't have found if you were consciously looking for it. But if you walk through the day with a sort of awareness and mindfulness, you'll spot those things that get you through that creative impasse.
Keith Sawyer. His new book is Zigzag, The Surprising Path to Greater Creativity. We want to open up our conversation to our listeners as well about how you contend with these kinds of questions in your life, or if you have a question for either Ori Brofman or Keith Sawyer about something you're struggling with in your own business or in your own profession, and you'd like some thoughts about how you can go about coming up with a new way to approach that particular problem. We'd love to hear your problems and put them in front of us. It's 866-733-6786 if you'd like to join us. 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can post your thought or problem on our Facebook page or on our website. Do these ideas, Keith Sawyer and then Ori Brofman, apply to anything? In other words, you mentioned Einstein a moment ago. Are these problems that apply whether or not you're a mathematician or an artist, an army general or a film director? Keith Sawyer first, do these ideas apply no matter what your particular pursuit is?
Yes, there's a surprising amount of overlap in the way creativity works regardless of your discipline. So, right, if you're a military general, or if you're a Nobel Prize-winning scientist, or if you're approaching the design of a new building at an architecture firm, there are some common elements to creativity that psychological research has identified, and we've touched on several of them today. I would say, though, that to some extent, creativity tends to be domain-specific as well. It is a little bit different if you're painting and if you're an army general, but we have findings from creativity research that I think would apply regardless of your chosen profession.
And what are those other common elements of this process, Ori Brofman, besides you talked about the need to give yourself space, white space, and we've talked about putting unlikely combinations of people together, that generates solutions. In that unlikely combination part, let me just ask, pursue that one for a moment. I assume it's important to have within that unlikely combination people who can make something happen. I mean, in your glove story, it's not as useful if it's just the janitors talking to other janitors. You need some docs in the room, right? You've got to have a pathway within that combination.
Exactly. So I call these people unusual suspects because they're not the kind of people that you would expect to be in the room. And unusual suspects differ from different organizations depending on the context. So in a hospital, the unusual suspect is a janitor. In the military, the unusual suspect might be a guy who was a peace studies major at Berkeley. The idea here is that when you put these same people in the room, when you create white space for them to have no agenda, when you invite an unusual suspect, you can create the foundations for what I call organized serendipity. And Keith touched about this a little bit. The idea that you can create serendipity and you don't know what's going to happen. It's going to emerge. Now, there's a caveat here. Simply sitting on the couch, simply hanging out with weird people is not going to get you to be creative. You need to do the hard work. You need to actually tackle the problem head on. The idea is that you need also organize chaos in the system to shake things up a little bit.
And does it also mean we have to take a break? But just real briefly, Keith Sawyer, does it also mean you have to be unafraid of the answer? I mean, part of what I think is difficult sometimes is you can say, well, I want to ask the right question, but then you have to be ready for the answer. And sometimes the answer is hard.
That's right. And people who are exceptionally creative and people who are serial innovators, that's right. They are open to the wandering nature of the process, the unexpected outcome. And that's absolutely critical. Yeah, to be receptive to the answer that presents itself to you.
And as you suggest in the title of your book, to zigzag, to not be afraid to sort of go, okay, I'm turning left here, even though I planned on turning right.
Absolutely. It's that sort of opportunistic movement in the direction that gets you closer to the problem solution.
All right. We will hear more from our guests and from all of you when we return. Join us if you have a problem you'd like to put forward at 866-733-6786. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. In today for Michael Krasny, our guest, Ori Brofman, whose new book is called The Chaos Imperative, How Chance and Disruption Increase Innovation, Effectiveness, and Success, and Keith Sawyer, the Morgan Distinguished Professor in Educational Innovations at the University of North Carolina. His new book is Zigzag, The Surprising Path to Greater Creativity. I want to hear about your own creative challenges. What are you wrestling with in your own lives and in your own professions? What is it that you would like to solve in order to get to a particular solution? You can join our conversation at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Let's go and hear from Jason first, who joins us in Salinas. Jason.
Hi, thanks so much. So the question I have for the panelists is more about institutional barriers. So I'm a college educator. I have 10 years teaching under my belt, and I realized really quick that if I wanted my students to more out of my classes, that I was going to do something different for all of the finals in my classes. So I do a very non-traditional final, but it has met a lot of resistance, not only from peers, but even some administrators over the years, because it has some guidelines, but it doesn't lay out everything that the students have to do in these large group final projects. It very much forces them to have to go through a lot of the process that you've talked about this morning. So how can I help institutional, whether it be peers, higher ups, be more open to this idea of organized chaos?
Great question. Keith, you want to take a swing at that?
Sure, yes, with a title like Educational Innovations. I think a lot about educating for creativity and innovation, and I applaud you for your efforts. There's so much of what goes on in traditional sorts of school classrooms that does not result in creative learning outcomes. We have a kind of expectation of teaching, and I'm talking about students as well as teachers, that in a classroom, we're there to have information delivered to us, and we're there to acquire information. And students get very good by the time they get to a university. The ones who get accepted in university are very good at mastering that system. So they are used to getting information and regurgitating it on the test, but that doesn't lead to creative learning outcomes. So I've done the same thing in my classrooms, where what you need is more openness, more improvisationality. You need students to be able to go through that wandering, unpredictable path themselves in your class. But, you know, human beings like certainty, and that uncertainty can be nerve-wracking, especially if you've been successful for 12 years of your life in schools that did not ask that of you.
So do you think, Keith Sawyer, that the resistance to what Jason is describing comes more from students than from institutions? That students are so concerned about doing whatever they think they have to do to get a good grade that there's more resistance there, perhaps, than in the institution itself?
I think it comes from both, but I was surprised to have it come from my students. I thought they would love a more creative learning style and a more creative environment. But, yeah, the administrators, absolutely, yeah, so there's all sorts of structural barriers to doing this. I think it's going to take some pretty dramatic change to educational institutions before we have creative learning outcomes.
And Ori Brafman, you write about how we sort of look to Japan as the place where they're so successful at getting their kids to do well on various tests and so forth and so on, and it's all highly programmed. But then we kind of miss part of what happens in Japan that speaks to the kind of environment that Jason would like to encourage.
We miss a huge part of the equation. So decades ago, when we realized that we're falling behind Japan and other Asian countries, we tried to emulate their educational models. And it's sitting down in the classroom, really going at it and getting students to study in a very rigorous way. And we've implemented that. But the more we've implemented it, ironically, the more we've actually fallen behind. And with the standards and with trying to have a very, very little variance in education. The part that we missed is that in Asian schools, children are actually given a fair amount of recess. On the other hand, here in the United States, in order to fit in all of this extra material that we try to shove into kids' brains, we cut away recess. And recess plays an incredibly important role in children. Children who have more recess actually end up forming closer bonds to each other. They end up actually performing better in schools because it's giving your brain enough time to reflect. It's giving you that white space.
So to back to Jason's problem for a moment, does he need to figure out a way for the administration at his college to have some recess? I mean, do they need some sort of open white space in order to buy into what he's proposing?
Exactly. And that's really where the idea of contained chaos comes in. No one's going to sign up for a classroom that's completely chaotic and don't know what's going to emerge. And the idea is that if you can contain some chaos, if you can solve a problem and you can say, this one problem we're going to give a little bit of chaos to and see what happens. The interesting thing is that organizations are allergic to variance. We say, okay, well, we want to be creative here and be innovative here for the next 20 minutes and see what happens. Good luck. And we're not willing to take the ideas that aren't as good, the ideas that are wacky. You're never going to be able to create a system where only good ideas are generated. So in order to be able to have a classroom that's more innovative, you also need to accept a class that's going to have some ideas that are less good, ideas that are less effective. And having that willingness on the part of the administrators is step number one.
How do you get the dean, though, to say, Jason, good job there for having not a very specific final?
Find a problem that has plagued the organization for years. So this problem of MRSA that we talked about before in the hospitals, the infection, they tried everything under the roof. They spent millions and millions of dollars on this, and nothing was happening. So they said, finally, okay, let's throw this up to a more chaotic process.
Jason, thanks for the call. Hope that was of some help. Let's go next to Vivek in San Jose. Vivek, go ahead.
Yes, hi. So I am very intrigued by this conversation, and in particular, you know, the guests have talked about this idea of white space and mindfulness. And I was wondering if there has been any research on people who meditate, are they more creative or are they more innovative in their lives, maybe in organizational settings? For example, at my workplace, you know, we've recently, there's an AWARE network that has been formed, which is encouraging employees to meditate on a more regular basis, with somebody coming in and leading a guided meditation once a week. And I was wondering if there's been some research on the benefit of meditation to organizations.
Great question.
I'll take the comment off there.
Vivek, thank you. Keith Sawyer.
Well, a few minutes ago, Ori mentioned this notion of the default network, what your mind is doing when you seem not to be focused on a problem. And creativity researchers have over and over again found the benefits of what we sometimes call incubation, or it's taking time off from the problem. And meditation is a wonderful way to get your mind defocused away from the work. Certainly there should be moments during the day when some people, you know, it doesn't have to be meditation, though. For a lot of people, it's physical activity. It's exercising, or it's gardening, or it's just taking a walk. In one of my books, I mentioned you know, back in the days when a lot more people smoked, and then office buildings started banning smoking. And so the smokers would have to go out to the sidewalk every 30 minutes or so for a 3 to 5 minute break for their cigarette. Now, of course, I'm not a smoker, and I wouldn't endorse that practice, but having that little break every 30 minutes absolutely enhances the possibility for your creativity.
And are there other ways, Ori Brafman, that organizations can kind of inculcate that sort of time and space? I remember reading about a nonprofit that had a reading day once a month where you couldn't do your work. You just had to read. And you could read whatever you wanted. It could be a novel. It could be something related to work. But the idea was to build into your 40-hour work week time that wasn't spent on your 40-hour work week.
Right. You certainly need to oftentimes schedule it because there's so many other constraints in your time. My co-author and I, Judah Pollack, we've done a lot of work with the U.S. Army. And you go in and it's very interesting. They realize, okay, this is a good idea. Therefore, we're going to make every single person innovate for at least 5% of their day. And it's an interesting idea. But the problem with that is that you run a risk of being too rigid about the white space. During this time, you will read, and during this time, you will come up with at least 5 creative ideas, and you will present them at the end of the day.
You're forbidden to respond by email when actually that might be a good thing to do.
Exactly. That you need a little bit more fluidity. You need to, yes, you encourage that white space, but that white space can take a whole host of different forms. It might be meditation for one person. It might be running for another person. It might be sitting and taking a nap for a different person. But can you, in your organization, can you imagine giving a little bit more tolerance, giving a little bit of saying, hey, there's a need for downtime. Oftentimes when people are encouraged to, quote unquote, innovate 20% of the time, it's not instead of the 40-hour week. It's work 40 hours, work 50 hours, and then on top of that spend. That's not really what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is taking some real white space that you need to protect from other forces that are vying for your time.
Brian writes in, please say more about the intersection between creativity and productivity. You've said something about how creativity works by lack of focus. Productivity seemingly would require the opposite. Keith?
Oh, that's a great question. And over again, there's a pretty solid finding from years of research that productivity and creativity are strongly linked. People who have great creative ideas are people that have lots of ideas. People who generate a lot of work are more likely to generate a work that's creative. So this has been found in physics and art, in writing, novelists, poets. And another sort of extension of that, in a year when you generate more work, you're more likely to generate exceptionally creative work than in a year when you don't generate very much work. So I guess I would say, no, there's not an opposition between productivity and creativity.
One of your guests, here's another comment that gets at the same question. One of your guests said that productive chaos isn't as simple as just putting weird people together on a couch, that you have to do the hard work. That sounds a lot like having an agenda. So how do you do the hard work without setting an agenda and limiting innovation? Great question. You were the fellow, Ori, who said it's not just sitting on a couch. So how do you combine what seems like oppositional ideas?
There is a difference between having an agenda and having a goal. Back to our hospital story. There was certainly a goal. They weren't just hanging out for the sake of hanging out, talking about sports, seeing whatever emerges. The goal was to reduce hospital infection. If you had an agenda, you'd say, okay, well, let's see how many posters we're doing and let's see how many trainings we're going to. And that's when you're taking away the creativity. And Keith and I are dancing around something called emergence. How do you let things emerge? Which is it sounds like a very San Francisco term. But there's actually both an art and a science to that. How do you encourage people from the outside of the from the edges of the network to contribute something?
What occurs to me in listening to this, and perhaps why I reacted when I was reading your book last night about having a meeting with no agenda, and I thought, oh, what a terrible idea.
Actually,
what I think I'm reacting to is not so much the idea of not having an agenda, but not having a meeting be led, because I think that's important, right? You have to have someone who's leading that discussion or not. I mean, my assumption would be that you want to have a meeting where it's not just sort of anything goes, anybody talk about anything, that you have to have someone orchestrating or no.
Sometimes, how many of us have sat in a meeting where the boss gets up for half an hour, talks at us, shows us a bunch of slides, and then after talking at us for a long time says, okay, let me hear all the creative ideas, and then yays or nays the creative ideas that come up. That's not a very effective way of actually getting all the voices in the room. There are other effective ways, and this gets back to what Keith was talking in terms of a jazz approach. This is not just a free-for-all. But can you get small groups to work together? Can you get everyone in the room to actually speak? Because it's incredible the amount of knowledge that there is in the room and how much of it we just skip over because someone's wearing that janitor's uniform. And how do you get their ideas? And how do you encourage them to come into the conversation? That's really where it gets interesting.
Let's hear next from Christopher, who joins us in Montreal. Christopher, you're on.
Hi. First of all, I enjoy your program very much, and I'm enjoying this program very much. So great topic.
Thank you.
I love your term, unusual suspects. I think that's absolutely wonderful. I would also add, in my perspective, I've been doing this work for quite a while as an internal consultant and as an educator. Also reconnecting the usual subjects in atypical or non-traditional ways can be helpful. So that working, to use a phrase, off the chart, not following the organizational chart and chain of command can also be helpful, along with unstructured.
Say a little bit more about what you mean by that, Christopher, reconnecting the usual suspects. How does that play?
Well, for example, you're talking about I used to work in an organization that was very paramilitaristic. It was in transportation, which in the U.S. came out of the Civil War. And so things go down the chain of command. If you connect the people higher in the organization with lower people lower in the organization, you get situations like your hospital example, where the janitors and the staff on the ground have an insight that's an aha moment for people higher in the command. That type of information usually doesn't survive the levels of communication that have to go up traditionally. So enabling a space where people can connect outside of the ways they normally connect allows for new information to flow.
Christopher, and I would also, yeah, go ahead.
And I would add to that that in my experience, it hasn't been hard work. The hard work is me as an educator or them as a boss getting out of the way. That people are actually, it's easier work for people to do once they've identified a creative solution because they don't feel like they're doing another change management initiative on something they know is going to fail. Having to put in the work to do something they know is not going to succeed is debilitating. Whereas if they get a better sense of what the problem is and what solutions are possible, that the work doesn't feel as much like work.
Christopher, thanks. And thanks for listening all the way from Montreal. Let's hear next from Eric. Eric, go ahead.
Hey, thanks for having me on. And it was a great show. And I kind of like, in a way, relate to what he's talking about in like my creative formats and stuff like that. But, you know, it's just something that's like really challenging, like in the world that I work, which is like politics. It's something that you really touched on something when you said, you know, information doesn't change behavior. And like there's a report that came out from Bloomberg today talking about how, you know, some of the counties, like most of the counties, like 211 out of 254 that are like the highest food stamp, you know, receiving counties in the country voted for Romney. And, you know, you think about the comments he said, some of the things the Republican Party stood for and stuff like that. And, you know, it's just like, you know, it's like you don't, how do you do it? Like, what is the creative solution you come up with? And it's like you can even do bigger, you know, it's like Egypt. You have these, you know, people that want change and they want to come up with a creative solution. And, like, I think in many ways creativity has sparked a lot of the Arab Spring, but it's like you have such institutionalized and, like, long-time-standing ways of doing things and, like, cultural behaviors. And it's just like, how do you break through some of these things that it's the way that things have been done for 100 years or 200 years, you know? How do you try to get that creativity going in there? I know it's a huge question.
Eric, thank you. Eric mentions Bloomberg in terms of, I think, Bloomberg News Service. But Kisar, you've written some about the Bloomberg, the mayor, and how his how that staff and office is organized. Can you talk a little bit about that and whether or not you think that contributes to finding creative solutions to political problems?
Absolutely. Top-down management can be very effective in predictable environments where efficiency is the goal and the environment's not changing at all or changing very slowly. But the kind of things that Ori and I are talking about are you're in situations where the environment's changing rapidly and you don't know where it's going to go and you can't predict the future. It's really about managing uncertainty. And that's where you find this kind of distributed leadership, this bottom-up emergent creativity. Sometimes people talk about self-managing teams. It's a little more complicated because it's less obvious, right? You can't point to one person who's in charge or one person who's doing it, and yet things get done. And if you haven't been in that environment, it can seem like an impossibility, right? Or must at least mysterious how it happens. So that's the challenge if you're in an environment of rapid change where you need creative adaptability to move in directions where you can't predict. That's when you need these kinds of distributed environments, this kind of emergent creativity.
And what happens in Mayor Bloomberg's office in particular that you find appealing? Or is that, I'm sorry, did I conflate who wrote about which? Or go ahead if that's yours.
Keith and I have been writing about very similar things and our friends, so there's a lot of parallels there.
Wrong attribution. Sorry about that.
Bloomberg has the office space that Bloomberg uses, it's not just an open office space, but he has what he calls a bullpen. And he brought it from his days back when he was in the private angle. And he actually sits in the middle of the bullpen in the bottom, and all his immediate staffers are sitting around him. And they can see all the meetings that are happening. There is no office door. They can just simply come down to him. They can hear all the conversations. They can chime in. The same office was used by General McChrystal when he was running operations in Afghanistan. What's interesting about that office layout is that it encourages serendipity. You don't have to email someone in order to get their attention. You see what's happening. All of a sudden, there's impromptu meetings happening because, hey, X is talking to Y, and all of a sudden, you're hearing the conversation, and you chime in. The idea is that if you have an open office that's just an open office, that's too chaotic. And if you have a rigid office where everyone's sitting in a cubicle, that's too rigid. Bloomberg has mastered the combination of having the best of both worlds, that jazz, if you will, that you can have those unlikely conversations, you can have a little bit of chaos, you can have that serendipity. All of a sudden, you have unusual suspects talking to another, right? You have someone from one department hearing a conversation from someone from a different department.
So again, more like jazz. You have to know how to play the instrument, but you allow for some improvisation, some unlikely combinations to go forward.
Precisely. These are New York City staffers. They're not sitting around on the couch just kind of daydreaming. They have a lot of knowledge. But how do you create an environment where they can actually interact and talk with one another?
Eric, thanks so much for the call. Let's go next to David in San Francisco. David, you're on.
Hello.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, great. Fascinating topic. So I'm hearing a lot about things like having meetings with no agenda and getting unconventional groups of people together and not spending too much time focusing on topic. And it's easy to see, on the one hand, how that could result in a lot of, you know, unexpected eureka moments. But as a practical matter, in our organizations, we can't spend unlimited amount of time doing this kind of stuff. So I wonder if you could talk about finding the sweet spot, you know, or maximizing the possibility of getting a, you know, a eureka or aha moment.
Yeah, no, great question. So that you're not just giving yourself forever to sort of spin around. Keith first, then Ori.
It takes some investment of time to be creative. So, yes, it's got to be some portion of the day or some portion of the week. There's a cost to the organization in staff resources and the payroll. If you're at Google with, you know, 20% a week focused on wild and crazy innovation, or if you're 3M with their 15% a week, every organization has to figure out, you know, how do we make the trains run on time and keep, you know, producing products that are generating our profits, and at the same time reserve a little bit of space for the next breakthrough or the next innovation. And that this 10, 15, 20% rule is one way of doing that. A more traditional way back from the 50s is an organization would set up a separate research and development lab where they would do all the innovation and everybody else was expected to just keep their nose to the grindstone. So the different ways to do it, but you're not going to have it if you don't distribute that time for innovation throughout the organization. I think you need to give everybody an opportunity to participate in creativity.
Should you? There's something, I think at least, useful sometimes, though, Ori Bruffman, about deadlines. I mean, because it does focus you. You can't. I couldn't this morning say, you know, I'm just not quite ready for Ori Bruffman and Keith Sawyer. I think I'll start the show at 10:35. You know, I mean, sometimes you have to be on time. You have to, and deadlines can be useful in a certain way. So to David's question about sort of the practicalities of this, should you sometimes start the clock? I mean, do you need to give yourself boundaries so that you have a specific outcome?
You absolutely need constraints, right? So if you started this program 10:35-ish, that wouldn't exactly work. My experience with the military is that there's definitely constraints that they have, and there's definitely problems that they're trying to solve involving national security. And yet, what's been really effective is taking these officers, taking them purposefully out of uniform, taking them away from base, taking them and getting them to talk to each other on a first-name basis regardless of rank.
Don't tell me you made them have a vegan meal.
I had a vegan meal in front of them. I watched them have steak. But there is some, there's a benefit to that. And it's within, it's not, this is now how they're running their lives on a day-to-day basis. It's a contained space. We keep on coming back to this idea of contained space, of having some kind of goal or some kind of final product. We have, however, as a society and as a business, we've made the mistake of thinking that being efficient means being productive. And sometimes being inefficient actually makes you more productive.
Say one more line about that. How does inefficiency lead to productivity?
Whether it's taking time to reflect, whether it's going about a problem in an unlikely way, whether it's having a meeting with no agenda where all of a sudden a eureka moment comes on, that is very productive. Hospitals have saved hundreds of lives and millions of dollars by reducing infection rate. You wouldn't have had this without the inefficiency of those meetings.
But there still needs to be an end goal. I mean, this process doesn't help us if we don't result in having fewer infections. I mean, you still need to be held to a certain standard.
Exactly.
Yeah?
You need that goal. So simply sitting around on a couch wondering about life is not going to fix things. But within an environment that has a goal, that has some kind of deliverable, having a little bit of contained chaos goes a long way.
David, thanks. Thanks for getting us onto that part of this topic. Let's go to Marianne next in San Francisco. Marianne.
Hi. Yes, I have a question. I've read some of Ori's other books, particularly on networks, and one of the things we're talking about here is how you engage a multitude of employees. But I'm interested in what about customer engagement and listening to the edges of a network, and could they speak a little bit about that?
Marianne, thanks. And I have been engaged enough in this conversation that I didn't realize that we have exactly 1 minute and 50 seconds left. So Ori first, and then Keith, I'll get a last thought from you.
Marianne, there's beautiful things happening in terms of engagement, all the way from the Occupy movement to Arab Spring to the work being done by Walmart employees. And all of those have elements of chaos in them. They're less structured. They're bringing unusual suspects into the equation. And that's really is driving a lot of the social change that we're seeing both in the United States and the world today. These are chaotic processes.
Last question for each of you to just give a quick thought to. If you're going on with the rest of your day right now and you've got something vexing in front of you, what's the first thing you'd recommend that that person do? Keith?
I would recommend taking a break. Talked about before. Take a walk and be aware. Look up at the windows of the buildings. Notice what people are wearing. Try to keep the problem you're focused on in the back of your mind and try to force yourself to make connections. Even with things that seem very distant from your problem, your connections might sound crazy, but sometimes those crazy ideas actually morph into a creative solution.
Ori.
Invite a little bit of chaos into your life because it goes a long way. Allow yourself to be inefficient. We're not machines. We're human beings, and these chaotic processes really help us have innovation and help us think about things in a brand new way.
And unfortunately, I have 22 seconds to be efficient and end this program. Ori Rafin, Keith Sawyer, thanks so much for being part of our show today. Appreciate it. Fascinating topic. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson in for Michael Krasny. Have a productive day.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.